So it's a pleasure to be back. It's always flattering to get an invite to speak. When I get an invite to come back to a place where I spoke once before, that's very flattering. You can figure out why that is. So we're almost there in the Parshios. We're not quite there yet, but I figured that I may not have an opportunity when we get there. So I wanted to talk about Yosef and his dreams. Happens to be my favorite character in Tanakh. And the dreams for all of us are fascinating. I remember when I was a kid in day school, I was unfortunately very, very bored during the morning classes, during the Limud HaKodesh. And the Rebbe would tell us, okay, open up to whatever, we're gonna learn whatever it was. Everything bored me. When we got the Yosef story, that was kind of interesting. So at least I picked up my ears a little bit. And I thought that I knew the story. Until I took off a couple years in between college at Columbia and law school at Harvard. I went to a place nearby called Or Sameach, and I was convinced after a few weeks that the Rav, who became my Rebbe, Zatzal, Rabbi Uziel Malevsky, must have been using a different version of the Chumash than the one that I learned when I was younger. Because the one I learned when I was younger was occasionally interesting, but even then not that interesting, and it went to becoming by far the most fascinating text that I had ever encountered. So I want to go through some questions that he asked, some questions that over the course of years of revisiting his explanations I added, and then I want to try to answer them. So the first question is, when Yosef has his initial dreams, the Torah tells us that his brothers were upset at his dreams and his words. I get it, they were upset at his dreams. He's dreaming that he's going to be ruling over them, lording it over them. They're very upset about that. What does it mean, and his words? What's going on there? Hashem doesn't throw away words. If it says something in the Torah, there's a reason why that gets added. Second question is, let's skip ahead. We know there are three sets of dreams. There are his dreams, then there are the dreams of the wine minister and the baker, and then there are the dreams of Paro himself. So Paro is incredibly desperate after he has his dreams. He's so desperate that he's even willing to take a criminal, a convicted criminal, who's a slave, who's a Jew, out of the dungeon to ask him to interpret his dreams, which is very, very weird. Why? Because Paro's in ancient Egypt, and in ancient Egypt, he must have had a dozen or more people on the payroll, and that's their job. He's got magicians, and he's got soothsayers, and he's got astronomers, and he's got necromancers, those are the people that consult the dead, and he's got, here's the word for it, neuromancers. Those are people whose job it is to interpret dreams. They're on staff. So what in the world is making them so desperate? Just go to one of your many people on staff, one of your Hartumim, one of your people who interpret dreams, and ask them what's going on. The next question is, when the wine minister tells Paro the background, when he introduces Yosef, he says, Your Excellency, Chata Ayni Maz Kirayom, I recall my sins today. And he says, you had put me and the baker in jail, and there was this young kid down there, a Jew and a slave and a lad, and we each told him our dreams, and then his lashon is this, Osi Heshiv Al Kani, me he put back in my place, but Oso Salah, and him he hanged. Now, if I'm Paro and I hear that, I say, I'm sorry, who put you back in your place? So Rashi has to stand on his head and say, no, of course he actually means Paro, but those aren't his words. His words are, he's speaking to Paro and he says, we told him the dreams, and he, Yosef, put me back in my place, and him, the baker, he hanged. Very strange. The next question is, when Paro is telling over his dreams to Yosef, he's changing some details. If you look carefully, look at the rendition the Torah has of Paro's dreams, and then look at how Paro repeats them to Yosef, and you see there's some subtle differences. And perhaps the most difficult question is as follows. Paro says to Yosef, I have heard it be said that you can listen to a person's dreams and interpret them. And the first thing Yosef says, you gotta love Yosef. He says, not me, contradicts Paro. Not me, God will respond to the dreams of Paro. So Paro goes and tells him over the dreams. And Yosef interprets the dreams. He says, really? You have two dreams? They're really one dream. What do they mean? They're going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And he doesn't stop for a second. He goes, and here's what you should do. And he proceeds to tell Paro what he should do. Now, number one, all Paro asked him to do was to interpret the dreams. He didn't ask him for advice. You go further than your mandate when you're a slave being brought out of the dungeon and you're a young Jewish criminal, and you go further than what Pharaoh, Paro at the time, the ruler of the world, asks you, your head's going to roll. But it gets worse than that. His advice is the following. Paro, listen, okay? This might be difficult for you. You're not that bright. I'm going to say it slowly. Maybe take notes. Paro, there are going to be 7 years of plenty. Then there are going to be 7 years of famine. Here's what you should do. Store food. Now, if I'm Paro, I'm saying, are you kidding me? No, but it was more complicated than that. It was put someone in charge and store food, okay? Paro, his reaction should be, I'm either going to hit you or I'm going to have five people hit you. That's his advice. Put somebody in charge and store food. Paro never going to figure that out. And Paro's reaction, not only does he not reprimand him, or worse, Paro says, could we ever find somebody so brilliant? So wise, so understanding, you're in charge. After me, there's nobody at a higher level. You're going to be the second in command. Because it's true what they say about the Jews. You guys are geniuses. Wow, 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine, store food. That's incredible. What in the world is going on? So let's start answering the questions. First one is, why was Paro so desperate? I'm not going to go in order, but I'll get to each question. Why was Paro so desperate? Paro was desperate because the people that he had on staff were interpreting his dream. Each one of them was coming back and saying, probably while trembling, Paro, your excellency, I want to tell you what the dreams mean. Now, how do I know this, what I'm about to tell you? Because it's open Rashi. Rashi picks up on the fact that it says that no one could interpret the dreams for Paro. The Torah doesn't say no one can interpret the dreams. It says no one could interpret the dreams for Paro. Why, Rashi tells us? Because everyone was telling Paro the dreams mean you're going to have seven daughters, and you're going to bury all of them. They're all going to die. Next person, he probably killed that guy, okay? Next guy, what do the dreams mean? Seven daughters, they're all going to die. Kill him. Next guy, each person he goes to is telling them the same thing over and over and over again. Seven daughters, and they're all going to die. You're going to bury seven daughters? So of course he's desperate. He is desperate beyond imagining. Give me somebody, anybody, who can reinterpret or interpret these dreams with a better interpretation. I'm even willing, why minister, who do you got? I got a young kid, a slave, a Jew. You know what? I got no choice. Bring up the young slave Jew, I'll give him a chance. So that's why he's so desperate. Now, Rabbi Malevsky Zatzal explained that there is a Gemara in Brachas that tells us the story of Bar Hedja. Bar Hedja was a well-known dream interpreter. And there was the hack about him was that if you went to him and you gave him a little schmear, you put a few coins in the jar, you'd get an excellent interpretation of your dream. If you didn't schmear him, you didn't get a good interpretation of your dream. So Abaye and Rava one night had the same dream. The exact same dream. And they said, you know what? We can test this out. We can test out the powers of this dream interpreter. So they go to the dream interpreter. One of them gives him the schmear, puts some coins in the jar. The other one doesn't. The one who puts the coins in the jar gets this unbelievable interpretation. It's going to be, you're going to be famous and you're going to be wealthy. You're going to be the head of the academy. It's going to be fantastic. And the one who didn't put money in the jar tells him the same dream, word for word. And he says, oh, I can't even tell you how terrible this is going to be. You're going to have problems in your profession. You're going to have problems at home. Horrible, horrible predictions, interpretations. And it's exactly what happens. The good interpretation happens for the fellow he gave it to, and the bad one happens for the other one. Later, they're on a boat, and Bar Hedges, as he's walking, a book falls out from his pocket or from his satchel, and they pick it up, and they see that it says that it all goes according to the mouth of the interpreter. Meaning, what they realize is that he had this power. Bar Hedja was somehow gifted with this power. He was a Baal HaChalomos. It wasn't that he had the ability to interpret dreams. He had the ability to decide what the dreams meant. Very powerful talent. Now you tell me, if Bar Hedja, whoever that was, had the power to be a Baal HaChalomos, to interpret dreams and decide on his own what they meant, you think Yosef HaTzadik, the Baal HaChalomos, didn't have that power and then some? On steroids? So the answer to this question as to what was going on is that Yosef had the power to decide what was going to happen in a dream interpretation, which means that when the wine minister came to him and said, okay, this was my dream, Yosef says, let's go. I'm going to get my way out of here. I'm going to put you back in your place. And by the way, remember me to Paro. Now he gets in trouble for that. He has to spend another couple extra years in jail because he showed some level of desperation. Why is it a level of desperation? It worked exactly according to plan. He interpreted the dream, so the wine minister would go back in his place. He told the wine minister, remember me to Paro. The wine minister did remember him to Paro, and that's what got him out of jail. Why'd he get punished? So just as an aside, Rabbi Milevsky used to explain the reason he got punished is that it was, at his level, it was a little bit of desperation. Because since he was such an exceptional evaluator of people's personalities, he should have realized, Mamonav Shach, as we would say in the Gemara land, whatever way I do this, it's going to end up the same. If I tell the wine minister to remember me, he's only going to remember me if it is an advantage to him. And if I don't tell him to remember me, he's still going to remember me if it's an advantage to him. So whether I tell him or not, he's only going to talk to Paro about me if he has a benefit. So it doesn't matter whether I ask him or not. Whether I ask him or not, if it benefits him, he'll talk to Paro about me. If it won't, he won't. That's exactly what happened. For 2 years, he gets the get out of jail free card. He goes back up to Paro. He doesn't say anything about Yosef. You know, there's this really good guy down there. I think he'd be good on our staff. Doesn't say a word. All of a sudden, Paro has dreams, and Paro is desperate, and he sees, ooh, I can get in good graces with Paro. Suddenly, he remembers Yosef. So that's why he got in a little bit of trouble. But what happens is that Yosef has this power that he can decide what the dreams mean. So he decides on the spot. You know what your dream means? Your dream means you're going back. In 3 days, you're going to be back in your position. So the baker says, oh, this sounds pretty good. How about mine? And so Yosef gives him his interpretation. In 3 days, you're going to die. Which, of course, leaves us with a very big question. Why did Yosef kill the baker? He killed him, if this is right. He didn't predict that he's going to die. He didn't interpret the dream. Let me think for a second. I think the dream means you're going. He killed the baker. Think about the Lushan of the wine minister. The Saramashkim said to Paro, me, he put back in my place, Yosef. And him, he hanged. He killed him. Somehow the wine minister figured this out, that he's really, really powerful. So how in the world was Yosef able to kill the breaker? You'll say, well, you know, maybe Yosef, he's only 17 at the time when he went down to Mitzrayim, and he didn't really have so much practice, and it's not that many years later, say he's all of, 30 years old or so, and he wants to practice, like, see, just how powerful am I with my dream interpretations? Like, could I kill somebody? Maybe I'll practice. I mean, the baker's not Jewish. I mean, I guess I could probably practice on him. Let me see if I can do it. I don't think you could do that. I'm pretty sure the Rebbeim in the room, I don't think you can, use non-Jews as target practice. I don't think you can use anybody as target practice. So how did he kill the baker? So I'll never forget this. It's only a few blocks away. I'm all of 21 years old, and I know this story, and I know I've been through, I know the art scroll sitter. So Rabbi Milevsky says to somebody, he says, can somebody just grab me a sitter? Okay. So somebody goes and grabs him a sitter, and they bring it over to him, and he opens up. He says, we say in the Slichas for a Sarah Bateves, I'm saying to myself, well, that's pretty random and obscure. We say in the Slichas for a Sarah Bateves the following. Every one of us has said this, maybe awake, maybe half awake. Probably we've said it. And maybe we've looked in the English, maybe we haven't. But I suspect that there aren't going to be too many people that say, yeah, right, oh yeah, I'm very familiar with that, what you're about to quote from the Slichas of a Sarah Bateves. So here goes, okay? In our tefillah, the Peitan, who's writing this, says the following. My adversaries, their mouths they opened wide, and my heritage they swallowed up exceedingly. They overpowered me. My blood they drank and swallowed. Foreign nations besieged me, and my brethren they wronged. They were those who said, destroy, destroy. They were the offspring of Seir the Horite, Edom. They said, let us go, let us destroy them and obliterate their memory. So we are talking about our most bitter enemies who want to destroy us. And now here comes our tefillah. Hashem, who is jealous and avenging, requite them. Let them bear their destruction in accordance with their deeds. Pay them and let them be ashamed of their hope. Now we're about to fill in the name of one of our most bitter enemies. The person who said they wants to destroy us and drink our blood. Who's our most bitter enemy? Unfortunately, because we're the Jewish people, you could start throwing out names and we'll be here for the next hour. This could be anybody. It could be Titus, it could be Nebuchadnezzar, it could be Haman, it could be Ahasuerus, it could be a Malek, it could be Esav. I mean, we got a whole rogues gallery. We got like Batman has a whole group of people. He's like this massive number of people who are his arch enemies, the villains that come against them. We have a whole list of arch enemies and villains. So who's the person? Here's our bitter enemy. You ready? God, pay them in accordance with their deeds. Pay them and let them be ashamed of their hope. the man who dreamt a dream of three wicker baskets. Guess who that was? The baker. So apparently the Peyton had access to a medrash, which a friend of mine later found from me years later, that said that the baker was planning to kill Yosef. And Yosef knew this. Bala Harug, somebody's coming to kill you, you kill them when you get the opportunity. So when the guy who's planning to kill Yosef was foolish enough to come to Yosef with his dream, Yosef says, let's go right now, right? Said the spider to the fly. Oh, let me hear your dream. This is going to work out real well, okay? And it's going to be over for you real fast. He killed the baker in order to protect himself. So now we understand already, we understand why Paro was desperate. We understand why the wine minister used that Lushan, because he's being accurate. Him, Yosef, he put me back in my place and he killed the baker. And now we could understand maybe why Paro was playing games a little bit, changing some details, because the wine minister has hinted to him, if you're that desperate, you may want to call this fellow up from the dungeon. But he's unbelievably powerful. He, not you, Paro, he put me back in my place. And he, not you, Paro, hanged the baker. That's how powerful he is. So if you give him your dreams, whatever he says is going to happen, it's going to happen. So Paro does this calculus. I don't have a choice. I got to save my daughters. So whatever he says, anything has to be better than burying seven daughters. But you can almost see the tension that he's changing some details of the dreams. Like, you know, maybe that'll cut into his power. Maybe he won't kill me or won't be able to the way he did the baker. It's very, very dangerous, and he gets it. And now we can understand what Yosef is doing when he gives the advice, because Yosef is brilliant. Paro gets it, and Yosef certainly gets it. When he gets called up, and of all things, imagine now with this scene set. He has this one incredible power. He gets called out of the dungeon, and Paro asks him what? I want you to interpret dreams. Imagine if you're Yosef. Interpret dreams. Can you imagine him? I imagine him looking up at Hashem saying, thank you for working this out. Paro, I would love to help you. Let me hear your dreams. And Paro tells him his dreams. And after he tells him his dreams, Yosef's got one shot now. He says, all right, Paro. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to find somebody, and you're going to put him in charge of the entire country to let him store the food. Paro, you following me? You're going to find somebody, one guy, and you're going to put him in charge of the entire country in order to store food. Do you hear what I'm saying? What he's hinting to Paro is, you think I don't know why you asked me to interpret your dreams? You think I can't figure out why you're so desperate that you had to call a Jew, a slave, a Nar, a young kid out of the dungeon to interpret your dreams with all these guys on staff? Paro, I'm wondering, did anybody tell you anything about burying your daughters? Maybe seven of them dying? You like my interpretation better? You want your daughters to live? Then you put somebody in charge of this country. It's an ultimatum. It's an ingenious ultimatum. And Paro gets it. I'm not playing around. Because what he's hinting to me is, if I stick him back in the dungeon, hey, I don't know if it's going to come true. I'm telling you, you like my interpretations? I'm in charge. And he puts him in charge because he's got to save his daughters. And now we can understand that the brothers' initial hatred of Yosef, why they were upset at him about his dreams and about his words, because he told them the dreams. But apparently the manner in which he interpreted them, he must have suggested it to them. They're saying to him, listen, we understand you're the Baal HaChalomos. We understand you have this incredible power. Why do you have to interpret the dreams, which he may have while going back and forth with them, that you're going to rule over us? Why can't it be? The dreams mean you're going to be Rothschild, you're going to be the banker, and every one of us will use your ATMs. And that's what this centralization will be. You'll be the central bank. Why does it have to be that you're interpreting the dreams and you have the power to interpret? Why are you interpreting them that you're going to be the leader? And so that's why they say, here comes the Baal HaChalomos. Let's see what will happen to his dreams, meaning we're going to get rid of him. Let's see if he's still so powerful that if we sell him to a bunch of traitors and he ends up in Mitzrayim, is he still going to be able to make those dreams come true? Little did they know. Oh, yes, he is. They certainly are going to come back later, and they're going to be bowing down to him. So the takeaway, I think, from this very powerful lesson is that each of us is the master of our own dreams. As we say that, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyirei shamayim, everything's in the hands of heaven, except for fear of heaven. You choose your spiritual destiny, you choose your ruchnias. And it is, the only limitation on that is your imagination. The only limitation is your dream. Now, this is very different than anything else in your life. What do I mean? You can't choose how tall you're going to be, how smart you're going to be, how good looking you're going to be, how wealthy you're going to be. Some of these things you can work at. Maybe you know you work hard, you put in more hishtadlis, and you dive into Hashem. Maybe you have some connection there where you can manipulate it a little bit if Hashem sees how sincere you are and you're going to use the money for the right things. But in general, you can't make these determinations. Very often, I'll go speak somewhere, and what'll happen is I see it happening up at the front. Somebody will say to somebody else, you know, are you going to introduce him? And the other person says, no, I don't know. You know, you introduce him. Okay, fine. So the person will walk over and they'll say, how should I introduce you? And I always answer with one word. I whisper back, tall. And they say, what? And I say, well, usually in an introduction, the person exaggerates. I always wanted to be tall. So this way you can get up and say, yeah, and he's tall. And I'll, you know, feel a little better instead of feeling 5'9". My oldest daughter, when she was a little kid, she would always hold the Havdalah candle on her tiptoes like this, okay? And I would say to her, she'd be 7, 8, 9 years old. I would say, Tamar, what are you doing, okay? There's no Jewish guy that's that tall. And she'd be holding it way over my head. Next, Motzei Shabbos, Havdalah candle in her hand, way over my head. What do you know? Her husband is 6'3", okay? So you can ask for things, but you don't have a choice over them, except the only thing you have full choice over is your connection with Hashem. You got full choice. That is your decision. Nobody's going to take that away from you. That is your choice. So when I went to day school and I was not particularly turned on, fortunately I wasn't totally turned off. I was just bored, as I mentioned before. Went off to college, did not keep up any of my studies. And when I was in between college and law school, I said, I got to figure this out because there's certain things that I'm doing because I did them when I was younger and I couldn't even tell you why I was doing them. There's certain things that I'm not doing, maybe I should be doing them. There's certain things that I'm doing that I probably shouldn't be doing or maybe I shouldn't be doing. Anything else in my life, I don't do halfway. So let me go check it out. So the first time I had gone to Israel earlier when I was 18, it did not end well. I was forcibly relocated from the yeshiva. You can figure out what that means. And I spent the rest of the year, in a city nearby that is not Yerushalayim. And it has a beach, and you shouldn't spend too much time there. So the next time I said, I'm gonna do this right. And so I went to Or Sameach, and from the very first minute I arrived, and the dorm counselor said, I'm gonna take you to your room. I'm going to give you your key, and I want to go over the rules. And I'm sure that I rolled my eyes, like, okay, here we go again. He's going to go over the rules. And he said, okay, these are the rules. No girls are allowed in the dorms. No drugs are allowed in the dorms. And on Shabbat, there are people who are keeping Shabbat, so don't turn lights on or off because they won't be able to turn them on or off. Remember, Or Sameach has some people who have already been there a long time who are very, very stark. And they have some people that have been there 5 minutes that aren't keeping Shabbat yet. So that's what he told me. I said, what about the other rules? He said, what other rules? I said, listen, I know a lot of people here don't have a background. I went to day school. I have a background. I know there are 613 rules, okay? So you have about another 610, you know, to go over. So could we just get this over with? He said, let me ask you something. If we forced you to do something here, when you go back to the States, would you keep doing it? I said, of course not. He said, so then why would we force you to do anything? First time in my life, he was a Rav. He was a Durham Cup. He was also a Rav. First time in my life that a Rav ever spoke to me like that. When I was growing up, it was always what you have to do, you have to do. If you're late for davening, go see the principal, you're in trouble. And I would say to the principal, "Why? I don't understand, I get it. So I'm supposed to be at davening. But why am I in trouble with you? I get it, maybe I'm in trouble with him, but why am I in trouble with you? I never understood that. The Rebbe, when I was very young, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, they're so friendly, they'd come over and they'd give me a little neck massage. Very nice, okay? Except it wasn't a real neck massage. You know what it was? It was they were checking to see, Herschel, come here. Let me check if you're wearing tzitzis, okay? So I was too young to do. What was I supposed to do? I'm 8 years old. Like, get, please. It's my decision and take your hands off. So this is the first time. You're a big boy. You're going to have questions. We may have answers. We may not have answers to everything. And if we don't, we'll tell you that. We'll be honest. And it was a sea change for me. It was at my own pace and at my own decisions. And so what often happens, though, and this is the most unfortunate thing that you can possibly imagine, is that we take the one area where we have choice, our ruchnias, our spirituality, our connection to Hashem, and we fold it up into little pieces and we hand it to the one person in the world that we hate the most. What do I mean? What I mean is that I have met countless people with a background, without a background, more often than not, people with a background. You know, I'd be more stark, my Yiddishkeit would be more important to me, my Judaism would be more important to me, I'd be Jewish instead of Jew-ish, if not for, fill in the blanks now, if not for that third grade Rebbe who hit me, if not for that seventh grade Rebbe who made fun of me, if not for that 10th grade Rebbe who just, you know, was obnoxious and totally turned me off, if not for my father, if not for my mother, if not for my grandfather, if not for my brother, if not for my sister, we blame somebody. It's the one area we have choice. And you take that choice and you give it to the one person you can't stand. The person that wronged you. And I'm not saying they didn't wrong you. I'm not saying that your third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, or bam, all may have wronged you. But you're going to give up the one area where you have choice and hand it to them? Why? Hold on to it. It's the one area where you've got choice. I want to shift here for a second because I have a little bit of a surprise. Suppose I told you that earlier today I taped $100 bills underneath each of your seats. Suppose I told you that. And suppose I said to you, he's already looking for them, okay? And suppose I said, guys, they're yours. I just, you know what? I just figured I was really going to like you guys. And I do. I could see from your smiling faces, you know, it's a gift for me. And, you know, I'll see you. Come visit sometime at Passaic. You know, you're all welcome to come for Shabbos, not the same Shabbos. You'd all reach under your chairs, right? I mean, who would say, no, I you know, money, it's just not important to me. I don't hold by money. I said, no, it's a gift. No, son of matanas yichye, you know, I hate gifts. Like, guys, listen, I'm not taking it back. If you don't take it, the guy next to you is going to take it. And I make that announcement, you know what? And if somebody doesn't take it, the guy next to you could take it. Probably, you'd all reach under and take the $100 and say, thank you very much. So can you explain to me why? When Hashem tells Moshe to tell Klal Yisrael, when you're leaving Mitzrayim, I want every single person to take the gold and silver, right? My brother jokes around. On Erev Yom Kippur, it's a mitzvah to eat. So my brother always says, only the Jewish religion come up with, it's a mitzvah to eat. Like, what a great day, okay? So here Hashem's telling him, this is a tzava. I want you guys to listen to me very carefully, because I know how frum you are. I want everybody to take gold and silver. I don't know, Hashem. That's a big ask. That's a really, really... We have to take gold and silver? I mean, we already have all of our stuff. We have our clothes. And where am I going to fit the gold? Who's not going to listen to that? So you think you'd have 100% participation in that most gewaldic of mitzvahs. Take the gold and silver. And instead, we don't have 100% participation. Who doesn't take gold and silver from Mitzrayim when they leave? Who doesn't take gold and silver? Moshe doesn't take gold and silver. Now, Moshe, I mean, you talk about somebody who is careful, punctilious about observing every single mitzvah. He's the one that transmitted it to Klal Yisrael. Hashem said, right, so what does he say to them afterwards? You know, do as I say, not as I do. Moshe, why aren't you taking the gold and silver? You know, it's fine. I don't need it. But Hashem said, it's a tzavah. Why didn't Moshe take gold and silver? Why didn't Moshe take gold and silver? Because he was taking Yosef's bones. Moshe was busy taking Yosef's bones. Now, that is a very big deal. A very, very big deal. But can I ask you something? The last time I checked, Moshe was from Shevet Levi. Okay? So where are the leaders of Shevet Yosef? Maybe Menashe? Maybe Ephraim? Right? Imagine if you had some, you know, let's say at the time when Rav Avadja passed, okay? And imagine one of the leading Ashkenazi Rebbeim said, you know what, I wanted to be the person to lead the procession at the funeral. I have a feeling that the leading Sephardic Rebbeim would have said, Kavod! I mean, he's ours, right? What is going on? Why is Moshe, now of course Moshe can pull rank, he's Moshe. He's the you know, it's good to be the king. He goes, nah, I know you guys were close. I get it, Ephraim, Menashe. You know what? He didn't want Ephraim and Menashe to fight? I got this one. Moshe, go take Levi's bones. By the way, they took the bones of all the Shvatim. Moshe, you go take Levi's bones. No, you know what? I already gave that to Aaron. I really want a really nice job myself. I'm taking Yosef's bones. What is going on? So maybe what's going on is the following. Let's go back. Helicopter view from above, right? Paro's daughters were going to die. Seven of them were going to die. They're going to die. He had the dreams, and the dreams meant that's what everybody's telling him, and they know their stuff. They are going to die. Yosef, our leader, reinterprets the dreams, and he saves Paro's daughters. So fast forward the clock. Mida keneged mida. What does Hashem arrange? Hashem arranges that when our future leader, Moshe, is in the basket, and his chances of survival are approaching zero, his parents have given up, and Aaron's given up. Only Miriam has kept the faith and is watching to see how Hashem's going to save him. So what does Hashem do? Paro's daughters are going to die. Our leader Yosef saved Paro's daughters. So now when our leader Moshe is going to die, who saves Moshe? Paro's daughter. It's a hidden gem in the Torah. Exactly, precisely, mida keneged mida. So I'm imagining Moshe saying to Ephraim and Manasseh, let me explain this. Of course, kavod. Of course I want to let you do this. But I'm the one who has a personal debt of gratitude. I never would have been saved by Paro's daughters if Yosef hadn't saved Paro's daughter. I wouldn't have been saved by Paro's daughter if Yosef hadn't previously saved Paro's daughter. And so you see this, that Hashem is so machped to repay things, mida keneged mida. So I want to tell you another story about mida keneged mida. And there are endless stories of this. You have to just, you know, be looking out and aware, and you'll find them constantly. So I have this chus of learning with a fellow named Rabbi Avraham Goldberg. And so three nights a week, it's Yarag Vayavar, 10:05 p.m. my time. That's 5:05 a.m. his time. We are on the phone and we are learning. So if you're ever looking for him at 5:05 in the morning, 5:05 to, you know, to 6:05, you'll know who he's talking to. So he told me the story a year ago yesterday is when it happened. He told it to me a week after that. So he told me this story, you know, a year ago minus a week or so. So what happened? What happened is that he arrives here every morning at 8:45 and he says Tehillim. And then after Tehillim, he starts his day of learning and giving shir, etc. But one day, he was invited to a bris that was called for 8:50 a.m., okay? Kind of like today. This morning, Bli Ayin Hara, we had the schus, we made a bris for, I had another grandson, and Rabbi Goldberg was there. We called it for, so 8:45, we were here at 8:45 in the morning in Zvil. But this particular bris was called for 8:50. Now, if it were you or me, probably, you know what, I usually get there to get there 8:45. The bris is at 8:50, I'll just go to the bris. Rabbi Goldberg, yeah, come on, 8:45 to 8:50, that's 5 minutes. So he gets here, he says, you know what, I have 5 minutes, but usually I say Tehillim longer, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn for 5 minutes, then after the bris, when I come back up, then I'll say the Tehillim. Fine. So he learns for 5 minutes, goes to the bris, comes back up, but he comes back up, he's right in the middle of his regular learning day, and he forgets to say the Tehillim. He just forgets to say the Tehillim. Later that day, during the Bein Hasdarim, he gets a text on his phone, and he lifts up his phone, and the text says, instead of a phone number, sometimes this happens, you get like, it's usually spam. It says words or letters instead of the phone number. It says, pray today. Oh, that's interesting. And he opens up the text and it says, Hatilim Hayomi, today's Tehillim are, and it lists today's Tehillim on the one day that he forgot to say Tehillim. So fine. He says to himself, this is unbelievable. I mean, what Hashkacha brought this? A friend must have signed me up for the service that sends you a text to remind you to say daily Tehillim. Can you imagine? He must have just signed me up yesterday or today, the one day that I needed the text, the one day that I forgot to say Tehillim. So he says, this happened a week ago, and I waited a week to tell you why. Because I was waiting to get the next text, and I haven't gotten the next text. And a year later, he still hasn't gotten the next text, which means he got one text out of the blue. No idea who sent it. I know exactly who sent it. No idea who sent it. Pray today, HaTehillim Hayomi, today's Tehillim, giving him that day's Tehillim. So I said to them, this is unbelievable. I had no idea that Eliyahu HaNavi has texting on his cell phone plan. I would have thought he has the plan that doesn't have texting. And I'm imagining, I'm saying that jokingly, but I'm not joking. I'm imagining Hashem Ab Shamayim saying, where are Rabbi Goldberg's Tehillim? I get Rabbi Goldberg's Tehillim every single day. Where are his Tehillim? Now, he didn't say, Hashem, you know, I'm in a bad mood. You didn't take care of me today. I'm not saying. He forgot. And he forgot because he wanted to get some extra learning in. I'm going to miss Rabbi Goldberg's Tehillim. I'm not going to send him a reminder. Listen, Rafe, Mike, Uri, you angel guys, give Gavi, okay? Call Eliyahu. Do that thing you do where you send the messages on the phone. Get him a message so I can hear his Tehillim. And he got a message. Because mida keneged mida. Because if you take care of Hashem constantly like that every single day, he's going to turn around and he's going to take care of you. You just have to, my Rosh Hashiva or Sameach, Rav Natan Shiller says, if you look for Hashem, you will see him everywhere. If you don't look for him, you'll see him nowhere. But certainly if you're looking for him, he will take care of you in directly proportional to the manner in which you he takes care you in the manner in which you take care of him. And I'll finish with one more Maisa Shahaya. I have a couple more minutes, so I'll share this with you. I had an unbelievable Mussar Haskell in my professional life recently. I am a plaintiff's personal injury attorney. If you've read any from magazines, I'm sure you've seen our ads for the Rothenberg Law Firm. I run our New York office. So I represent people who get injured in catastrophic fashion. I represent people who have lost mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, the toughest cases, sons and daughters. People have lost arms, legs, the ability to see, eat, walk, the horrifying cases. So I was working on a case with a very, very serious injury, and I had gotten money from one of the defendants. It was relatively straightforward. And the other defendant, I had a claim that was a tenuous claim that I was confident that if we went forward, I probably was going to end up with a zero at trial. But because it was a serious injury, they were worried about it. So as we got closer to trial, they were offering more and more money. So eventually the offer went to $800,000. They said, look, this is about all we have. And they said, look, you know, let us know. Like if there's a number above that, I don't know that we can get any more. Let us know and we'll see if we can get any more money. So I thought about it. I've been doing this a while and said, here's what I'm going to do. I don't do this that often. I'm going to draw a line in the sand and I'm going to tell them a number that's beyond what I think they could possibly get to. If they get there, that's a home run. Probably they'll meet me in the middle, which is also a very substantial number. So I said, it's got to be $1 million. It's got to be $1 million. Now, we're never going to, I said, listen, it's two of you. Put your heads together. See if you can come up with $1 million. If you come up with $1 million, I don't care how you do it, who puts in what, you can somehow get $1 million. That's the number that I need to settle the case. So they come back. I was very surprised. Instead of with $900,000, they didn't call my bluff and they said, we got it. We got $1 million. I said, great. Okay. So we're settled. Well, I just need to call the client just to confirm. So I call the client. I say, listen, you know, it's a very serious injury. I know you want more within the confines of the insurance coverage as it exists. There's no way that I can get more. So I'm telling you, this is the number and we should settle it. I didn't think I'd ever get to this number. I got you $1 million. You got to settle the case. He says to me, he's not Jewish. He says to me, Harry, do you believe in God? I said, Mike, what do you think this is? Do you think this is a fashion accessory? I wear it because it matches my suit and my tie. I said, of course I believe in God. He says, well, so do I. And so I think I'm going to let God decide this one. I'm going to go to the jury. I said, Mike, God is telling you to take the money. Don't do something stupid, okay? Don't go to Las Vegas and put it on red and risk it. You're going to end up with less. There's no way I can get you this much money from a jury. You're going to end up with less money. I can't let you do this. But you know what? We still have a couple weeks until the trial. I'm not going to twist your arm. Think about it. I'll be in touch. Every few days, I call him up. Mike, what do you think? Harry, I'm just, you know, I'm putting my faith in God. I trust in God. Mike, you got to know how to understand God's messages. I tell him the old joke, the guy who's drowning, and they throw him the life raft. God will save me. He ends up drowning. God, where were you? Who do you think threw you the life raft? Who do you think, you know, sent the helicopter, right? God's telling you, take the money. Nope, I believe in God. Comes the day of the trial. I have him come down to the court, and I sit him down again, and he says, look, I'm prepared. I understand that I might get more. I understand you're telling me I might get less, but I just feel that if the jury speaks, that's like God's words. And I'm putting all my faith in God. Okay? So I go in and I speak to the law secretary. The judge doesn't get involved often, sometimes, but often doesn't get involved in negotiating the case because he wants to be neutral and doesn't want to feel maybe somebody's being unreasonable and then I'll rule against him. So the law secretary gets involved. I said, what's going on? So I tell him the whole story. I say, the good news is we reached the number that the lawyers in this room all agree is the right number to settle the case. He says, so why aren't we settled? I said, because the client won't take the money. So why not? I explained to him, he believes in God. He believes that God is going to speak to him through the will of the jury. He said, well, let me ask you something. He said, is that what it is that no matter what the number is, he won't take it? He'll only go to the jury? I said, no, I think if we can get him some more money, you know, he might be able to take it. He said, all right, you know what? Is there any chance of that? So I said to him, hinting, and I hoped he would pick up on the hint, I said, I cannot ask these guys for any more money because I told them $1 million. So he took the hint. He said, you know what? Why don't you step out? He could ask them for money and he can twist the arm. He represents the court. So he comes back in to see me and my client. He says, look, I don't know if I could do it, but I may be able to get another $100,000. If I get you up to $1.1 million, will you take it? So I say, Mike, if he gets you up to $1.1, you understand what that'll mean. It'll mean that I've been telling you, God's telling you to take the million, that I'd have been wrong. And you'd have been right. You'd have been right that God was telling you to say no. So let's see if he can get it. And he thinks about it and he says, if you can get the other $100,000, I'm going to settle the case. The guy goes back in and he convinces the two sides to each chip in a little more and he gets $1.1 million. Now you can imagine, right? Here's a guy who's telling, I was not willing to risk the number. Of course I believe in God. Here's a guy who, based on his belief in God, is willing to risk the number. He said to me afterwards, you have to understand, after I suffered this injury, I had nothing left. And I just said to myself, either I'm going to give up on everything, or I'm going to put all my faith and my trust in God. It's just unbelievable. So when I came back that the after this, when we settled the case, I spoke to my morning chavrusa, Rabbi Mordechai Becher, who writes the Ask the Rabbi questions, the answers to those questions. And I said, listen, this is this incredible Mussar Haskel. What was going on? Like, did he have a better number than I did, you know, to up to Shemayim? Like, am I dialing, you know, the wrong number? I don't have the right access code, and he does? So he said, you're asking a very interesting question. The later Mikubalim disagree, but the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim says, and he does not distinguish between Yidden and non-Yidden, he says that the degree to which Hashem reaches out to you and gives you is directly proportional to the amount of faith you have in Him. The more faith you have in Him, the more you get back from Him. You understand what he's telling me? That it is possible. That even with my big yarmulke, and my tefillin, and my davening three times a day, that this fellow who's not Jewish, but who said to me, I put all of my faith in God, maybe he got a little more because that was directly proportional. Now, of course, you know that to me it meant that I got to work harder and be more serious. When I say, yeah, I believe in God, yeah, do you just say that? Or have you put all of your faith in God? You put all your faith in God, you get back endless amounts. I do I don't know if I'm allowed to recommend this, but I will just point out that if you ever find yourselves on the internet, which you shouldn't, the only website I could possibly ever recommend is one called Torah Anytime. Because if you're going to go on the internet, why would you go on the internet other than to watch or listen to a shiur? So if you go on Torah Anytime and put on my name, you'll see I do a short weekly video on the Parsha or on the Yom Tovim as they come up. It's shorter than this talk. They're usually 3-4 minutes long. Hope you'll enjoy them. And thanks for listening. Be well.